Welcome to the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine. Meet 'em, greet 'em, treat 'em, and street 'em. Today's date is January 22nd, 2019, and I am your skeptical host, Ken Milne. The title of today's podcast is Pain, Pain, Go Away. Intranasal ketamine versus intranasal fentanyl for pediatric pain management. And we've got a great guest skeptic. It's Dr. Samina Ali. She is a pediatric emergency physician, clinical scientist, and professor of pediatric and emergency medicine at the University of Alberta in Edmonton. She focuses on pain. Her research is on improving the assessment and treatment of children's pain, and Dr. Ali is currently an executive member of Pediatric Emergency Research Canada, a faculty member with Pain and Children Health, co-chair of the PERC Pain Interest Group, pain content advisor for TREC. I think you're starting to get the idea here, SGEMers. And she's also a faculty member of the Best Evidence in Emergency Medicine. Welcome to the SGEM, Samina.
Thank you so much, Ken. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm glad you're excited because I have been after you. I have been trying to get you. I have been bugging you, I think. Well, maybe bugging you. For at least, I don't know, 2 years since we met at Ski Beam back in Sun Peaks.
Ken, you're too kind. Yes, I do remember Ski Beam. You taught me a lot there. The most important of which was that it is perfectly appropriate to wear a purple sequin jacket for business attire.
I thought you were going to say to be skeptical, but okay, yeah, if you want to wear something sparkly, wear something sparkly. But I was impressed by you. I mean, I got to watch you as a pediatric emergency medicine expert. But what you brought to your lectures, the style, the communication, the connection with the audience, you truly do have a gift, and I know I'm gushing.
Oh, you're very kind, Ken. Thank you.
Well, Ski Beam is one of the most amazing CME activities you can ever participate in. Great faculty, great hill for skiing and snowboarding. And it's not too late to attend because Ski Beam is just around the corner, January 28th to 30th. Are you going this year?
Sadly, not this year, Ken, but definitely on my radar for future years because it was an amazing time.
All right. Well, why don't you give us a case for today's podcast?
Okay. Well, let's talk about a 10-year-old girl who comes to your emergency department after falling on a zip line at the playground. And she used her arms to break this fall because she was trying to protect her head. And she immediately realized that her left wrist was really sore. And so her parents bring her to your hospital. And when you see her, when she arrives at triage, she's crying and her pain is 8 out of 10. And there's at least a 3 to 4 hour wait in your emergency department that day to see a physician. So your team wants to provide pain management until she can be further assessed. And then incidentally, they mention at triage, the mom has severe hypotension after she received IV opioids. And now they're scared to use them with their daughter.
Well, pain is the most common reason for an emergency department visit in children. Patients who experience adequate pain relief during their ED stay had significant reductions in distress, improved rapport with their physician, improved intent to comply with discharge instructions, and higher level of personal and caregiver satisfaction.
Absolutely true, Ken. And conversely, untreated pain in childhood leads to short and long-term problems, including anxiety, needle phobia, hyperesthesia, and fear of care, within the healthcare system as adults. And effective pain management is being increasingly regarded as a cornerstone of high quality care. In fact, the importance of providing optimal pain treatment is supported by the World Health Organization, the American Academy of Pediatrics, and the Joint Commission.
Well, children represent one group of patients that are less likely to receive adequate analgesia. This phenomenon is known as oligoanalgesia, or poor pain management through the underuse of analgesia. And, you know, we've discussed pediatric pain with pediatric emergency medicine superhero, Dr. Anthony Crocco, back on SGEM number 78. He even did a ranthony on this issue, and I'll put a link in the show notes.
A great rant. That's one of my favorites to use when I'm talking about pain. Absolutely. So, on the topic of musculoskeletal injuries, like our young friend has, it's a really common cause for emergency department visits for children with pain. And believe it or not, a child's risk of sustaining a fracture ranges from 27 to 42% by the age of 16 years. So, this is super common. And MSK injuries are known to generate moderate to severe pain in most children, and our emergency departments serve as the critical entry point for these injured children.
Despite 3 decades of pain research in this area, recent evidence confirms that emergency department pain management in children is still suboptimal. A retrospective cohort study of children presenting to the ED with an isolated long bone fracture shows almost a third receive inadequate medication, and over 50%, something like 59%, receive nothing, no pain medication, during that critical first hour of assessment.
You're absolutely right, Ken. We've done previous studies, our team itself, as well as a colleague of mine, Dr. LeMay, and they've demonstrated that only one-third of children presenting to Canadian pediatric EDs with fractures or severe sprains receive any analgesic. And our medical record review of two Canadian emergency departments showed unacceptably long delays in the provision of analgesia, with children waiting a mean of 118 minutes to the provision of first analgesia. That's almost 2 hours.
Whoa, like that's just too long, isn't it?
Absolutely.
As such, clinicians have sought faster-acting, effective, and easy-to-administer pain medication to children with acute musculoskeletal pain injury and moderate to severe pain. Two potential options are intranasal ketamine and intranasal fentanyl.
So, intranasal fentanyl we're comfortable with. We know it's an opioid, but ketamine is a non-competitive N-methyl D-aspartate, or NMDA, and glutamate receptor antagonist that provides analgesia by virtue of decreasing central sensitization, wind-up phenomenon, and pain memory. So subdissociative ketamine has gained recent popularity for pain management and trauma as another opioid-sparing alternative, and its use is associated with higher rates of minor but generally well-tolerated adverse events.
We have covered low-dose ketamine a number of times on the SGEM, and I'll put the links in the show notes.
So, subdissociative ketamine appears to have the same analgesic efficacy as intranasal fentanyl or IV morphine in the earlier studies for fracture pain in the emergency department. And the IV dosing of this subdissociative ketamine is 0.1 to 0.4 milligrams per kilogram. However, the intranasal dosing for subdissociative ketamine is 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilogram.
And similar to intranasal fentanyl, intranasal ketamine shares the advantage of early and rapid pain management for children who lack vascular access, but confers the added benefit of longer-lasting analgesia. It's about 60 minutes for the intranasal ketamine and 30 minutes for the intranasal fentanyl.
Right, and intranasal fentanyl is an excellent alternative to oral or IV opioids when rapid acute pain management is desired, or if IV placement is not otherwise necessary or considered a challenge to establish. Intranasal fentanyl at doses of 1.5 to 2 micrograms per kilo provide adequate and rapid analgesia that is comparable to that of IV morphine.
And the time to administration of analgesia is reduced when intranasal fentanyl is compared with IV analgesics such as morphine. Intranasal fentanyl, administered via mucosal atomizing device, is an excellent medication choice for the rapid treatment of moderate to severe pain while awaiting topical anesthetic cream to take effect prior to IV cannulation.
It's also useful in the pre-hospital setting.
That it is. All right, what's the clinical question?
Is intranasal ketamine non-inferior to intranasal fentanyl for pain management in children presenting with acute extremity injuries?
And what's the reference?
So Frey et al. Published a study entitled "Effect of Intranasal Ketamine versus Fentanyl on Pain Reduction for Extremity Injuries in Children." Gave it the cool acronym of the PRIME randomized clinical trial, and they published it in JAMA Pediatrics in December of 2018.
You do have to have a cool name for your study, don't you? All right, what was the population?
So they studied children aged 8 to 17 years of age presenting to their emergency department with moderate to severe pain due to traumatic limb injuries with a visual analog score greater than 35 millimeters.
And they had a number of exclusions, and I'll list those in the show notes. What was the intervention?
Their intervention was intranasal ketamine at 1.5 milligrams per kilogram, up to a maximum of 100 milligrams.
And what did they compare it to?
They compared it to intranasal fentanyl at 2 micrograms per kilogram, up to a maximum of 100 micrograms.
Let's go through their outcomes. What was the primary outcome?
It was the difference in pain reduction between groups 30 minutes after treatment, as measured by the visual analog scale.
And what were their secondary outcomes?
They had a couple of them, and they included sedation levels as measured by the University of Michigan sedation scale, the capnometry values, adverse events, the need for rescue analgesia, and any changes in vital signs using PALS as their reference.
So the author's conclusions were, quote, ketamine provides effective analgesia that is non-inferior to fentanyl. Although participants who received ketamine had an increase in adverse events that were minor and transient, intranasal ketamine may be an appropriate alternative to intranasal fentanyl for pain associated with acute extremity injuries. Ketamine should be considered for pediatric pain management in the emergency setting, especially when opioids are associated with increased risk. End of quote. All right, Samina, we're going to go through the 11 quality checklists for RCTs. Here's the first question. In this study, was the population included or focused on those in the emergency department?
Yes, it was. However, the study was in an American tertiary care pediatric emergency department.
The patients, were they adequately randomized?
I would say yes. The randomization was achieved using computer-generated randomly varied blocks of 6 and 8 using a 1-to-1 ratio within those blocks.
And did they conceal that randomization process?
Yeah, mostly yes. Allocation was concealed using sequentially numbered sealed envelopes, and blinding after randomization was ensured by using syringes with identical volume, color, and odor. Currently, computer randomization is considered more secure and less likely to be broken, so that's my only hesitation.
The fourth question is, the patients were analyzed in the groups to which they were randomized.
Short answer, yes. However, they could not do an intention to treat analysis because 4 patients were withdrawn before medication administration.
Were the patients recruited consecutively?
No, they were not. They stated they enrolled a convenience sample.
The patients in both groups were similar with respect to prognostic factors.
Yes and no. Yes for baseline pain score. No, because fentanyl had notably more boys, and those boys had a greater mean weight. So there may have been implications for total volume of drug absorbed, as larger volumes required for greater weights would be less well absorbed and more likely to drip out of the nose and drip into the mouth.
All participants were unaware of group allocation.
Theoretically, yes. Emergency department and study staff, the patient and family members were all blinded to the intervention. However, 63% of the time observers guessed the group allocation, which suggests greater than chance.
All groups were treated equally except for the intervention.
Yes, it does appear so.
Did they have good follow-up?
Yes, 86 out of 90 were included in the analyses overall. 85 out of 90 made it to the 60-minute mark, although it is unclear how many were retained to the 120-minute end of study mark.
All important patient outcomes were considered?
I'm a little unsure on this one. So no direct patient or family inquiry regarding their satisfaction or desire to use the same medication again were made. More and more, this is becoming an important part of trials, so I would have liked to have seen that.
And the 11th final question is, the treatment effect, was it large enough and precise enough to be clinically significant?
Yes, they did meet their sample size calculations using the smallest minimal clinically important difference, or MCID, that is considered possibly acceptable.
All right, let's run through the results. They enrolled 90 children with half allocated to each group. The mean age was 12 years. What was the key result?
Ketamine was non-inferior to fentanyl with regards to the primary outcome of pain reduction at 30 minutes after study medication administration.
Yeah, both ketamine and fentanyl saw about 30 millimeters decrease in pain. And as the 95% confidence intervals around those point estimates crossed zero, but they did not cross the pre-specified non-inferiority margin of 10 millimeters. How about the secondary outcomes?
There were no significant differences observed in the highest achieved sedation scores, mean capnometry values, vital signs, or need for rescue analgesia between the two groups.
Well, there were 47 patients that experienced 63 adverse events. More adverse events were observed in the ketamine group versus the fentanyl group. Now, all of the adverse events were considered minor and transient. The relative risk of an adverse event in the ketamine group was 2.5. There were no significant differences in the number of adverse events between groups at each assessment point, except at the 15-minute mark, where ketamine group had much more drowsiness.
20 patients, so 23%, required additional analgesia, 11 in the ketamine group and 9 in the fentanyl group, which was a relative risk of 0.89.
All right, Samina, time to get to that nerdy talking, my favorite part of the podcast, and we're going to go through five things. You're the guest, so I'm going to give you the opportunity to go first, which means you'll get 3 out of the 5 nerdy points.
Such a gentleman, Ken. So starting with blinding, they used sealed envelopes, but they did not specifically say they were opaque envelopes. This could have led to some gaming of the system and introduced selection bias if the recruiting research assistant had views about how they wanted things to go. So as previously stated, computer randomization is considered more secure and less likely to be broken.
And I'm just going to build on that and make blinding number 2 or part deux point, because I always want to get to 5. And if I don't quite have 5, I add another. Or if I have more than 5, I try to combine them. So number 2 point is also about blinding. And we really like that they ask the staff to guess group allocation at that 30-minute assessment point. And that was the primary outcome. And because more than 50% guessed correctly, it was actually 63%, it suggests that blinding was not maintained, and this could have introduced bias.
Speaking of bias, let's talk about selection bias. They did not have consecutive patients, but rather a convenient sample of patients. 31 out of 140 eligible patients, almost 22%, were excluded because the research coordinator was not present, the patient was not in the proper location, the study enrollment was on hold for some regulatory purposes, or because of clinician preference. This could have introduced some selection bias in the study and impacted the results and the conclusion of non-inferiority. And while we're on this topic, another point about selection bias. They chose greater than 35 millimeters as their inclusion criteria for pain. Isn't that kind of low? In my practice, I would use oral pain medications first before considering intranasal medications. In our soon-to-be-launched trial, the NOOCH study, we're going to use greater than 49 millimeters because we're using a stronger opioid. So I was surprised to see 35 as their cutoff.
I'm optimistic that you'll get that published because of the cool name. No ouch, I think I heard.
That's right.
No ouch. Look for it to be in print soon. All right, the fourth point was about removal of co-dosing. They removed co-dosing of ibuprofen with intranasal medications in this study design. Ibuprofen works. It's opioid sparing. And while in need of a study to confirm, it likely provides smoother and more sustained pain reduction over the ED visit when combined with intranasal medication. While this design allows for a pure answer to the effectiveness question of these two meds, this is not how we should use it in practice.
Last point I'd love to talk about is medication dosing. So one of my pet peeves is when a study shows no difference between arms and one or more of the arms use suboptimal dosing of a drug. Thankfully, this study did not do that. They used appropriate higher end of dosing range doses for their study. And so their dosing regimen helps me feel more confident in their results.
And so those SGMers who follow me, this is a logical fallacy sometimes in study design when they do a straw man comparison. So you're comparing one drug to a very low dose of the comparator drug. And so it's a straw man comparison. All right, let's comment on the author's conclusions and compare them to the SGEM's conclusion.
So the author's main conclusion regarding non-inferiority for efficacy seems reasonable and is congruent with their results.
But you wanted to say a little more about this, didn't you?
Yes, I would like to talk a little bit about their statement regarding pre-procedural sedation and analgesia limiting of opioids, as this is not consistent with my own decision making. If I think opioid will provide the best pain relief and adverse event profile for my patient, I would use it and be mindful when dosing for procedural sedation and analgesia afterwards. From the BAT paper that they refer to continually to make this point, a direct quote from there is, "Although we do not recommend limiting opioid use to treat pre-procedural pain, we believe that awareness of this risk factor will help clinicians prepare for sedation and anticipate potential adverse events." That's from the BAT paper. As such, I don't agree with Frey et al. When they keep stressing this as a reason to use ketamine. I think of ketamine as another valid pain-relieving tool in my toolkit to be considered when making clinical decisions at the patient level.
Are you done? Are you finished? Is that it? That's all you want to say?
I think so.
Okay. How about you give us an SGEM bottom line?
Okay, after that rant, I'll keep it short. Intranasal ketamine appears to be non-inferior to intranasal fentanyl for efficacy, but with more adverse events.
And how about a case resolution?
So, in consultation with the emergency department physician, the triage nurse administers 10 milligrams per kilogram of ibuprofen and 1.5 milligrams per kilogram of intranasal ketamine. The pain at 15 minutes is reduced from 80 to 50 millimeters, and at 60 minutes, it's 40 millimeters. She goes on to receive her X-ray, confirm her diagnosis of her minimally displaced and minimally angulated distal radius fracture. She's splinted, SGM number 19, if you want to hear a little bit more about splinting. And then she's sent home with appropriate follow-up pain management and when to return to the emergency department if necessary.
Okay, so how are you going to take this paper and clinically apply it then, Samina?
Well, this is another reasonably well-executed study that shows intranasal ketamine is a valid pain-relieving tool in our toolkits to be considered when making clinical decisions at the patient level. If monitoring neurologic status is really important to the clinical presentation, for instance, when they have a concomitant head injury, then intranasal fentanyl may be the better choice. However, some families voice really strong opinions regarding the avoidance of opioids, and ketamine allows this to be respected. However, personally, I don't see ketamine as a safer option for addiction or misuse and dependence risk, as it's also a drug of abuse.
So, what are you going to tell the patient, this 10-year-old girl, or her parents at the bedside?
So there is no reason for your child to be in pain while we sort this out. If you have hesitations using opioids, I have another option for rapid pain relief. It works as well as opioids, but will likely make your child more drowsy or dizzy in the first hour after its use. What do you think?
And now it's time to announce the Keener contest winner. Last week's winner was no one. That's 2 weeks in a row, people. Perhaps the questions are just too hard. The answer Justin was looking for was there are references to opium use in Mesopotamia around 3400 BCE. They referred to the opium poppy as Hulgil or the joy plant. I hope you've got an easier question this week for the SGEMers,
We do. Our question this week is based on the recently completed Canadian multicenter cohort study by Bat et al., published in JAMA Pediatrics in 2017. What is the safest agent to use for procedural sedation and analgesia in children?
If you know the answer to this week's Keener question, send an email to the sgem@gmail.com with Keener in the subject line. The first correct answer will receive a cool skeptical prize. Well, thanks, Samina, for finally coming on the sgem. I'm glad I was able to twist your arm and get you on the program.
I was so happy to be here. Thanks for this opportunity, Ken.
Now, are you able to give the sgem tagline?
Remember to be skeptical of anything you learn, even if you hear it on the Skeptic's Guide to Emergency Medicine.